Try a free sample of berry pie?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait. Will this send me spiraling out of my routine?
Time to consult the online experts.
One bite will destroy your metabolism. Drink butter coffee instead to kill cravings.
What? Is it really that bad? I had protein this morning, right? Ugh, but it looks so good.
Only eat after walking 10,000 steps.
Pie is only 2 steps from here. Am I overthinking again?
Fruit ruins
Never
insulin
Never eat after 7 p.m.
One cheat day.
Cut carbs by 30%.
Fast for 48 hours.
Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. No fads, no fear. Just your signal. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com. That's Cygnos.com with code SPARK. Cygnos.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. Oh. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true.
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy. It's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Even after Brian Koberger confessed to killing 4 college students, one question has never left the public imagination. Why? Because when you look at what happened in Moscow, Idaho, in November of 2022, there is no simple answer, and you're never going to get one. The victims didn't know him personally. They weren't part of a feud with him. They weren't in danger because of the lives they were living. They were just 4 young people in a college town. And then one night, all at once, they were gone. Months later, in 2025, Koberger quietly scribbled something on a court document that made people stop cold. He was waiving his right to a mental competency hearing. But in the process, he disclosed 4 diagnoses. Autism spectrum disorder, level 1, obsessive compulsive disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and something most people have never ever heard of, avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, or ARFID. It read like a checklist of his mind. Some saw it as him peeling back the curtain on himself, as if these clinical terms were clues to the violence that he carried out. But here's the truth. Those words may give us insight into who he was, but they don't come anywhere near explaining or excusing the choice to walk into a home at 4 a.m. and end 4 lives. Let's go back to that night. November 13th of 2022, a rented house on King Road, right next to the University of Idaho campus. 6 students lived there. Only 4 would die. Investigators believe the killer entered around 4 a.m. He moved fast, efficiently, room to room, and by the time he left, Kaylee Gonzalez, Madison Mogan, Zanner Kernodle, and Ethan Chapin were all dead. One roommate later recalled opening her door after hearing noises. She saw a man in a black wearing a mask walking right past her and out the front door. He didn't run. He didn't lunge. He glided past her, almost calm. She froze in place. locked her door, and convinced herself she hadn't really seen what she thought that she saw. By sunrise, the reality was undeniable. Four students, four lives cut short in brutal fashion. For weeks, there were no arrests, no names, just fear and speculation, but investigators were building a case. They had a white Hyundai Elantra on camera circling the neighborhood. They had cell phone records showing someone's phone pinging near the house a dozen times before the murders, nearly all of them late at night. And then there was a knife sheath, tan leather, stamped with a Marine Corps insignia, left behind next to one victim. On it, DNA. That mistake would undo everything. On December 30th of 2022, Brian Koberger was arrested at his parents' home in Pennsylvania. A criminology PhD student from Washington State University, just miles from the crime scene. A man who studied criminal minds, taught classes on policing, and according to prosecutors, spent months planning a massacre. People who knew him weren't shocked. They were unsettled, but not surprised. At WSU, where he worked as a teaching assistant, female students complained he was condescending, dismissive, openly rude. One professor warned colleagues that if Koberger ever became a professor himself, they'd one day be reading headlines about him stalking or harming women. He cornered students in doorways. He relished tears and tearing others down in debates. He gave up off the kind of energy that makes people joke nervously about incels, men who stew in bitterness towards women. Except in this case, the joke didn't feel so funny once the truth actually did come out. Even his high school friends remember the transformation. Back then, Koberger was overweight, bullied, awkward. He fell into heroin use back in his teens, despite it was a desperate escape, rather, to get himself away from the animosity and adversity. He reinvented himself, basically. He dropped the weight, had surgery to remove the excess skin, swapped heroin for control, control over food, over his body, over his image. His friends said it was extreme, punishing, and his personality shifted just as hard. He became aggressive, alpha-like, putting friends in chokeholds to show his strength, belittling them to feel superior. The kid who once felt like nothing decided he would make everyone else feel smaller than him. All of that is a backdrop for the diagnosis he revealed years later. Autism, OCD, ADHD, ARFID, lots of letters. They're clinical terms, but when you lay them alongside his behavior, they do take some color. Let's start with autism level one, sometimes called high-functioning autism. People on this end of the spectrum live independently, succeed academically, even thrive in certain areas, but they may miss social cues, struggle to read emotion, fixate intensely on narrow interests. Think about how people described Koberger: flat, unemotional, detached, awkward in social settings, fixated on criminology with a zeal that went beyond academics. Autism could help explain some of that. And here's the thing. Autism doesn't make someone violent. Studies show people on the spectrum are no more likely to commit crimes than anyone else. In fact, they're more often victims. Millions of people live with autism. They struggle socially sometimes, yes. They feel like outsiders, yes. But they don't break into houses and kill. Some actually create podcasts about murderers. So while autism might have shaped Koberger's demeanor, it doesn't excuse what he did. Then there's the OCD, obsessive-compulsive disorder, not the "I like my desk neat" stereotype. The real thing, intrusive, unwanted thoughts and rituals that temporarily quiet them. For Koberger, control seemed to define everything. His relatives described his eating rules as extreme. He refused to eat food cooked in pans that had ever touched meat. Family had to buy new pots and pans just for him. It wasn't veganism, it was obsession. He studied forensic science like someone preparing for battle, wrote papers on how investigators avoid leaving trace DNA. When he allegedly carried out his murders, he turned to his phone, wore gloves, stalked the house in advance. All the signs of someone compulsively focused on control. But again, OCD doesn't create killers. In fact, most people with OCD fear harming others and go out of their way to avoid it. Koberger's excessive streak might explain his meticulous planning. That doesn't erase the fact that he chose violence. There's ADHD. We think distracted, restless, but ADHD can also mean hyper-focus. Locking onto one thing so completely, you shut out the rest of the world. Koberger's hyper-focus was crime. He lit up when classes turned to the gory details. He was consumed by criminology. Did ADHD make him kill? No! Did it feed Koberger's fixation? Maybe some of that, possibly. But planning a murder weeks in advance, circling the house over and over, covering his tracks, that's not ADHD chaos. That's deliberate. And then you have the ARFID, the least known. Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder. It's not about body image. It's about fear and control. People with ARFID eat only certain foods, avoid textures, sometimes even fear choking. Koberger's obsessive diet, his rigid rules, his visible anxiety about food, that fits. It tells us how tightly wound he was. How much he needed to control even the smallest details of his life. But ARFID doesn't lead someone to violence. It just shows us the mindset, a man so rigid, so consumed by control that even dinner had to be a battleground. So do those four diagnoses explain Brian Koberger? They explain quirks, yeah. They explain his detachment, his obsessions, his need for control. They may help us understand why people found him so strange and so unnerving, but they do not explain murder. They do not excuse the decision to stalk, plan, and slaughter four young people in their beds. Because here's the truth, millions live with autism, OCD, ADHD, ARFID. They go to work, school, raise families, work jobs, live lives. They do not kill. Brian Koberger is not defined by those labels. He's defined by what he did. And even he knew it. In court, when he pled guilty, he said clearly those conditions, you know, they're part of him. He knew exactly what he was doing. Idaho law wouldn't have let him plead insanity anyway. That's almost beside the point. He didn't try to use these diagnoses as an excuse, although his attorneys did certainly bring them up. He never did go to trial. Ann Taylor at one point did float the autism as a reason to spare him the death penalty, but in the end it didn't matter. The evidence was overwhelming. He took the plea, four guilty counts, four life sentences, no parole. So what's left? Just that question. Why? Maybe that's the hardest part. Because no label, no acronym, no diagnosis will ever give us a satisfying answer. What we're left with is a man who studied evil and chose to embody it. A man who let his darkest impulses out into the world. The diagnoses are footnotes. The murders are the headline. And no matter what was scribbled on that form in court, the reality is simpler. Four promising young lives are gone because Brian Koberger wanted them gone. That's the story. That's the why. It has nothing to do with autism, OCD, ADHD, or ARFID. It has everything to do with choice. A choice that Brian Koberger made and a choice that Brian Koberger will live with for the rest of his short, pathetic life behind bars. Tell me your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube if that's where you're watching us. If not, just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and you will find us there. Wherever you're downloading podcasts, press subscribe as well so you don't miss any of our coverage on this and the many cases we got for you right here at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Love to get your thoughts. Let me know. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
When someone shows you who they are in public, it's rarely during the big moments. It's in the little ones. They think no one will remember. In the last few days, we've seen more of those small snapshots surface. The hotel desk blow up over a billing error, the instant pivot from anger to charm, and the next day, hallway chat that drifted into talk of knives and sheaths, because obviously that's what you bring up when you're trying to flirt with a stranger in a dim corridor. Add in neighbors describing tapping on windows and campus colleagues flagging predatory boundary crossing behavior. None of it is a courtroom exhibit. All of it is part of the picture, though. And here's why it matters. Micro encounters don't solve a case. They map the social mask, how someone manages impressions, probes for power, and leaks preoccupation when they think it reads casual. The hot cold switch at a hotel desk, it's not just moodiness, it's control theater. I can escalate. I can disarm. I can test what you tolerate. The hallway knife talk, that's not edgy small talk. That's fascination looking for an outlet, maybe validation. And those night noises and window taps that neighbors bring up later, some will be noise, some might be real, but the cluster tells you what people felt around him, watched, unsettled, and alert. There's a community question baked in as well. What do we do with soft warnings? Creepy isn't a crime. Sexist comments, predatory vibes, boundary pushers, most of that never makes it into a reportable statute. But after the fact, people stack those moments together and ask, was that a flare we ignored? It's not about blame. It's about literacy, knowing what's a red flag versus what's just awkward. What can be the difference between shrugging off risk and documenting a pattern? So let's take these micro encounters seriously without overhyping them. They don't replace hard evidence. They explain the ecosystem that formed around him, the discomfort, the near misses, and the way he showed up when he wanted something and how he behaved when told no. Former FBI special agent Jennifer Coffendaffer is with us, and she's been through enough of these to separate rumor from pattern. Here's the moment we're going to start with. June 2022 in Pullman, he melts down at a hotel desk over a bill, then flips to friendly. The next day, steers a private hallway chat towards knives and sheaths. Thoughts on that and on his fixation? Because it sounds like a theme we keep hearing in these offhanded interactions of Brian Koberger.
Yeah, you know, this is the thing, Tony. It was churning in his mind for so long. This plan, this hope, this crime, this cathartic moment he had hoped to achieve. And you can't just not think about that, you know, when that's what you think about 24/7. So he makes a lot of what I would call almost spontaneous utterances. There's things that are going on in his brain and he just can't help himself. So I find it actually to be pretty normal with somebody that's obsessed.
Yeah, I mean, that really is what it feels like. It's very obsessive behavior to be going on and on and on about these certain objects. And this is before anything has even taken place that he's out there obsessing on it. I'm even after who knows what he was like if he had a conversation with him about a knife sheath. Neighbors also described tapping on their windows, and I found this interesting. If he's trying to not be seen, if he's trying to not be known, do you think the tapping has anything to do with Koberger, or is just kind of a little, maybe it is a red herring out there, and folks who were this close to the fire of Brian Koberger, you're going to think maybe anything odd, any odd noise could have been him.
I think it's a combination.
Yeah.
I think it possibly could be him. You know, we talked about other scenarios, whether they could have been him or not in last time we spoke. So this could have been him, maybe. But like you said, everybody now is thinking, and I know it's not now, but whenever they were interviewed are thinking, whoa, I think this could have been him. I remember this particular incident. I heard anything. But on the flip side of that pancake is, you know, I think he was certainly probably into peeping, could have been into burglarizing. And imagine that excitement you would feel then if you tapped and then, you know, kind of caused them to have a sensation of fear.
Like a recognition that you're there without them knowing that you're there. I mean, that I can see that being something very appealing to a co-burger-like person. There's been so much talk about, okay, see something, say something. A lot of people did. I mean, there was a lot that was said about Brian Koberger. But at the end of the day, you got to do something. But what can you do? What can you do with all these soft warnings that were out there about Brian Koberger? The sexist comments, the predatory-like behavior. But, you know, there was nothing that I think would have necessarily landed him in jail unless they caught him, you know, peeping out someone's window. But the stuff that people were complaining about, yeah, he was a creepy, weird guy. And you can't predict the future, though. I mean, was there anything more that could have been done as everyone was seeing stuff and saying stuff?
I love the words you just use, soft warning. These are warning signs that people see about a lot of people. I mean, mm-hmm. There's a lot of weird cats out there. There's people who, you know, misogynistic, who treat women terribly bad, who say really random, odd things. And we always think, oh, well, that guy just socially is awkward. Mm-hmm. All of this summed up Brian Koberger. And when you look at the other people that do things like this, none of us say, oh my God, that's a mass murderer. I bet he's going to be a serial killer, because it's so rare. It's so rare for those ingredients to equal mass murderer. And it's something we just don't really, it doesn't compute.
Sure. I mean, it doesn't always equal serial killer by any means, of course. I mean, the odds that you're going to go that far are pretty out there. But the odds that someone that's behaving in those ways might be doing other things, maybe not murdering, but other things. I don't even know how you'd quantify that, actually, you know, could look into every single one of those. But we have. There we go. I think we popped out and came back for a second. So many things that we would say might be soft warnings. Is Koberger a narrative tale? Is there anything we can learn from soft warnings? Or is it just, this is the world we live in? Do we need to do something more about these soft warnings so they're not so soft?
Well, he has such soft warnings, right?
Yeah.
Look at, as an example, the murderer that just got done with the Annunciation shooting. And he had hard warnings, right? He had guns, bulletproof vests. He, you know, before the attacks was, you know, writing horrible things and putting it on YouTube and talking in Russian. So when you compared those, which I call those hard warnings, Koberger's weren't really. And I could see why people just overlook this behavior. But I will say, with the long running of the soft warnings that his family certainly were aware of, like you said, it's not something that you say, okay, these weird behaviors equal they're going to be a serial killer. Yeah. But wow, maybe we should be looking out for getting this guy some help.
All right, let's land this where most conversations don't, on the uncomfortable middle ground between see something and say something. And what are you legally supposed to do with creepy? We've got a cluster of moments, the hotel desk escalation, the charm pivot, the knife and sheath chatter, neighbors spooked by taps on glass, colleagues who said his behavior tripped wires. Individually, none of those are a silver bullet. Together, they read as a pattern of testing. Can I push you? Can I unsettle you? Can I get you to accept my frame? That's not social awkwardness. That's calibration. And if you're looking for a takeaway that actually helps, it's this. Document patterns early. When conduct skirts the line, boundary violations, targeted pestering, fixation topics that keep resurfacing. If you're around somebody like that, write it down. Report it up the chain that exists where you are, campus, workplace, property management. Patterns either fade under daylight or they sharpen under scrutiny. Both outcomes are useful, not because you'll catch a killer every time, but because you'll raise the cost of escalation for the tiny percentage of people who are looking to escalate. And for storytellers, us included, resist the urge to turn every odd encounter into prophecy. There's a lot of weird cats, as Jennifer put it, who will never cross the line into violence. Soft warnings are signals, not sentences. The value here is literacy, recognizing hot-cold control plays, understanding why weapons talk isn't edgy foreplay, and clocking the difference between awkward and coercive. That kind of fluency doesn't eliminate risk, but it lowers the odds that a pattern hides in plain sight. Big picture, the photos in the apartment show us inside what he cleaned when he thought it mattered, what he ignored when he thought it didn't. These micro encounters show the outside, how he managed strangers, how he tried to charm his way past no, and how his obsessions leaked into when he believed, or leaked into what he believed would be harmless. Put them together and the portrait is less mystery and more map. If you're listening and thinking, I've met that guy, here's your marching order. Trust your read. Like I said, document what you see and tell someone who's tasked with tracking patterns. And if you have no one to tell yet, just keep documenting. Because once you get enough and you actually have a pattern, not just here's one creepy thing, here's the pattern of creepy things, people pay more attention. Not everything turns into a headline. And thank God for that. But quiet paper trails do save lives. That's where we'll leave it for now. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're listening to us or watching us so you don't miss any of our coverage on this and the many cases we follow for you right here. And let us know your thoughts in the comment section as well. I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Oh, we have a lot to go over today. Adelson's, of course, we're going to dive into that. This is a day Donna is going to decide whether or not to testify. We'll talk about that. We'll also take a look at some testimony from a jailhouse snitch that says she almost got a grand piano out of Donna. You know, it's a little bartering that, you know, you don't expect to do in prison, but, you know, Donna's got the goods. So we'll do that. We'll take a look at Donna's best friend's testimony on the stand, which I don't know that it did a whole lot for Donna, but we'll talk about that. Also going to be talking with Jennifer Coffendaffer today about Harvey and Wendy Adelson. What sort of future might be held for them after Donna is found guilty or innocent, in the far chance that that happens. And then Siobhan Scott's going to be joining us, psychotherapist and author, and we're going to go into the world of family enmeshment, which essentially is the Adelson family. Is it good? Is it bad? Why do so many people keep coming back for more? We're going to talk about all that in the second hour of the program. But be sure to press subscribe wherever you're listening to us or watching us so you don't miss us every day. And in the comments section, be sure to let us know your thoughts, your questions, and we'll try to get to them throughout the program today. But first, we're going to start with some new breaking news. Brian Koberger, there's a new detail that has come out that's not going to be just floating away from our radar. It's not about the crime itself, but what was happening in his private conversations right after. And when you hear it, you can't really help but ask what exactly was going on here. So the night after the murders, Brian's mother, They're talking, as they have been. As you know, Brian Koberger and Mom are pretty tight. They were talking the morning of the murders, right after, for several hours, and then throughout the day later. He was on the phone with her constantly while he was in jail. But this is an interesting one. The night after the murders, Brian's mother sent him a news article. It was a link. Not just any article. And I don't know how odd this is. That's why I'm curious to get everyone's reaction on it. This one spelled out how Zana Kernodle had bruises all over her body and how she had fought back against the attacker. That's what was being alleged in that article. I mean, think about this for a second. Mom sending her son a link to the story about the brutal murder. Maybe normal. I can kind of understand that. But does it land a little differently while the two of them are already on the phone together? Obviously, she probably doesn't know that, you know, Lil Bri is the one behind it. But does it strike you as normal? Let's just start there in casual conversation that Mom would be sending Brian, you know, links to this horrible crime. It did happen where he's at. So is it strange on that level? Let's start there.
Well, it's odd. Now, I say that as we have an audience of people who love true crime.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I mean, it has to do with the area that he was in. It was a huge news story. So yeah, that could make sense. But then if you turn it on its side and go, wait a minute, that's some really unusual banter between a mom and a son, I think.
Well, it depends, I guess, on the relationship. I mean, what's unusual? If you and your mom talk about true, if
you talk about mother and, you know, like, if you're like they had a relationship.
If you're into that topic, what's weird about talking about that topic? I mean, yeah, her son turned out to be the killer, but I don't see it as being that out there. I mean, when, for example, like, so Devil's Den, that occurred here where the monster went into the woods and killed the husband and wife recently. And we were covering that quite heavily before they found the killer. You know, my mom's, you know, sending me, you know, articles about it and stuff. Wow. And I'm letting her know, sending her what I'm reporting about it. So, you know, we talk about those sort of things somewhat. We don't dive into every case. If I said Karen Reed, she'd probably have no idea what I'm talking about. But I don't know. From that dynamic, I don't know that it's that weird. But the topics I talk about sometimes with my mom and my parents, I know are kind of odd.
Yeah, but look at what you do for a living. You are the exception. Yeah. I mean, well, but he's a criminology student. So, again...
Is it odd? I don't know. I mean, look, I remember when I was a kid going into the radio station and telling Todd some of the conversations I had with my mom, and Todd would be like,
Wait, what's going on there?
And in true Todd fashion, I remember none of that. So
no, you blocked it out is what happened.
Yes.
Yeah. But like, I don't know how odd that is on the surface, but that's gotta be a weird one to have to try and, you know, comb through all this time later.
Yeah.
You've got to be looking at everything that he said to you on those phone calls and going, you know, what does it mean? What was he saying? I mean, it gets even stranger right after that, their conversation, her texts the next morning, to him. And this is interesting. And this is all from some of the criminologists and some of the folks who were digging into the Cellbrite data. And this is what they were telling Ashley last night on Banfield on News Nation, that her messages veer into coffee beans, a line about a sweet girl working at a coffee shop, totally disconnected from the weight of what they had just been talking about. It does appear that there might be some pieces to this conversation that are missing. As we know, he was deleting things, but what we do have is her communication to him, not necessarily his out or what they had spoken of. So, I mean, it kind of leans a little bit towards Well, it looks like they had been having some sort of conversation about some girl he thought maybe was cute that worked at the coffee shop.
Well, and remember, we've talked about the barista who had a close run-in with him.
Yep.
So what part of that conversation's missing here, where he's obsessing over this woman who knows nothing about him?
Yeah. And he's talking to mom about her.
Yeah. And, you know, you don't talk to mom about somebody unless things are cooking, I guess, you know?
I wouldn't think, but
we don't know the dynamic either.
Yeah. What's odd about it is that both the topics, the bruises all over the victim's body, okay, that is something that, from my understanding, he might really enjoy talking about because of what he's into. I mean, we know that about him.
Yeah.
And then the coffee part of it and the barista and all that. It's just, if you just look at it by itself, if you didn't know everything that went down in that situation, be like, just conversation, little weird. But this was like, it was almost feeding him to me.
He seems to have very few modes of what he talks about and what he goes on. I mean, it's interesting as we learn more about him. He enjoys talking about knives and knife sheaths, as we know that he loved, like, just randomly talking to the woman at the hotel about that in the hallway. He likes to talk about the coffee and the girl at the coffee shop. It's very narrow obsessions that he goes on, which, you know, goes with the autism. That's a lot of thinking. You do get more narrowly focused on things, but he seems to have no way of functioning outside of it. Like, he needs somebody to trip him up and go, okay, Brian, next thing, next step, let's keep moving here. Because he really gets onto that. I'd be really curious. I'd love to know from that mom, what was that conversation like about the bruising? I hate gory details. I do not like talking about them. We don't show the pictures. We don't do any of that shit because I don't think it adds to the story. But what I am curious about is that conversation. Was he excited? Did that perk Brian up to sit there and talk about, well, I think this might have happened or that might have happened? The way that Papa Roger character came out online and said, well, I think this, and seemed to have knowledge beyond what was in the current publishings of the moment. If mom could look back and say, well, how did he know that?
Well, but don't forget too, and I'm not defending Brian Koberger. Please don't ever put me in that category. But being a criminology student, this is his arena. This is where he thrives. This is where, you know, he's studying this. So I remember in the days of, when I went into radio, everything music was talked about with me, like, oh, we should talk to her about that. Or when I went into veterinary medicine, like, oh, here's this really weird case that, you know, was in the paper for some reason. Or so people gravitate toward those topics. Maybe that was just an innocuous, hey,
he's into that.
Yeah.
He's going to school for that. Let's talk about something that maybe interests him.
And again, you brought up the autism. I've been doing some reading about Temple Grandin. Very, very amazing human being. But she talks about how people on the spectrum, their thoughts aren't linear. They're just very segmented and all over the place. And to people who are not on the spectrum, it looks very odd. Incredibly odd. But to them, that's a normal.
Yeah.
So from our perspective, not being on the spectrum, it's really disconcerting to see this journey that they take to get through a topic.
Well, especially when the topics are very off, when they're like,
exactly.
If
he were not a criminology student and he went into great detail about, you know, what happened at this crime and really was digging into the details, I would be very alarmed. But he has that degree. So to me, it's like, it's just another day at the office.
What does it say, though, about, like, that his mom is the one he's turning to constantly after these horrific things? He literally just killed four people. And now if you read the tea leaves, he's talking about the cute girl at the coffee shop, which we now know he had some sort of interaction with that made her uncomfortable. It makes you wonder, you know, he's already the fact that he's able to sit there and think about some like another human being in any sort of like, maybe I'll date her sort of way after just murdering four people. It makes you wonder. I wonder how much in code he spoke to his mom. I wonder how much, you know, gazing at the stars meant something else other than it seems to mean. If he was speaking in certain ways of, you know, I got a crush on this girl or I like this girl, is more like I'm going to stalk her. I've been staring at her outside her window, mom. She likes Pantene Pro V. Do you like Pantene Pro V, mom? I want to buy it. I want to smell it. You know, that sort of, you know, creepiness.
Maybe he didn't have the capability. It sounds like I'm defending Koberger. Stop me. I'm not.
We know you're a pro burger.
No, I'm not. I'm honest to God. I'm not. Mm-hmm. But I'm, again, doing more reading on this. He does not connect with other people. No. On an emotional level. He does not know how. And not that he couldn't learn, but I think it's really difficult. And I just don't think he had the fostering environment for that to occur. So he doesn't relate to people. He makes people feel very uncomfortable with the interactions. And I just don't think he has a lot of friends. So mom's always going to be there.
He doesn't know how to navigate people.
Right.
That's his thing. That's a very hard thing with autism too, because you don't naturally know how to do it. So it's like a lot of learned type behavior, but he doesn't seem to value that lesson. And if he doesn't value that lesson, he just continues to hit his head against a brick wall, never going, maybe that's a lesson I should pick up on because it might help me get from point A to point B. But he's always just like hitting up against the wall. I don't know why nobody wants to talk. Like, well, that's exactly. You. Another interesting piece of that reporting about those letters beyond the reporting that he was talking about with his mom and that letter that she sent to him. He sent some letters to Washington State University around that same time at his teaching assistantship was in jeopardy. He responded not with one, but two very different letters. The first letter was very groveling. He begged to keep his position, stressed how much he needed the insurance, emphasized his GPA and his dedication. It was like a pleading type letter. Please keep me. Then a little bit later, sends another one. That one flipped. It went after a female professor directly in it. It laid out why she was wrong and he was right. No humility, just pure arrogance in that one. Like Jekyll and Hyde, depending on who he knew was going to be looking at this letter. And specifically, we see his anger towards a female erupting again. It's the same personality that we've heard described by his colleagues. I mean, he's late to classes with female professors, never the male ones. He's rating female students horribly, ignoring the men, dismissing women, but showing deference when he wanted something. And his best buddy appears to be a woman, his mom, his attorneys, all female. What the hell does that say about Brian Koberger?
I wonder if he saw them as female, though. I wonder if he was able to strip out their gender, that other women that he didn't need or know, they were women, but the ones that were close to him or that he desperately needed, like a professor, like a mom, they weren't women to him. Does that make sense?
Like he just categorizes everyone differently. But the people who are below him in his mind, below in intelligence, if that's how he scales everything, they're women.
Yes.
But if there's an intelligent woman next to him,
she's different.
She's something else. Or
putting things into those compartments that he needs to be able to relate to them because it's so uncomfortable.
You open this door, he respects him. He loves his mom. He trusts his mom. He trusts these attorneys. And shut that one, open this door over here, and they're pieces of meat and can't be trusted. And it's pulling the doors back in all these different bizarre ways that Koberger does.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key.
and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, guys. Here's my morning routine. First, I drink olive oil. Next, I take an ice bath. Ooh, feeling super healthy.
If your health advice sounds strange coming from a kid, maybe it's just strange. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com, Cygnos.com, with code SPARK. Cygnos.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. No purchase necessary. See rules at playmcd.com for full details and amoe.playmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.